Blog Talk Radio.
Nine to 6 degrees in the shade. Rehot in the shade. 96 degrees in the shade. Red hot, oh yeah, in the shade.
Hey.
And though we grieve, my soul, I know we grieve your soul. There were heroes out there. There were heroes out there. What you gonna say when the question asks? What you gonna say? What you gonna do when the judgment comes? Where you gonna hide? You gonna run to the rock to hide yourself. The rock wants a hiding place for itself. Run, Babylon. Run, Babylon. Run, Babylon, not your dread of come. Run, ball head. Run, Babylon, not your dread of come.
Was that leader of first strike? Special show this evening. I am Yah Elohim, and I'm so glad you're here. I can't wait to launch into the program. As you see from our marketing flyer and our show page, that we are talking about the 151st anniversary of the Morant Bay Rebellion. So you want to stay tuned because it's really all about healing. It's about our freedom fighters. So our entrance, first of all, we know Third World, 96 Degrees in the Shade, which is about the Morant Bay Rebellion. The actual title of that song is 1865, which is the year in which that rebellion occurred. And then after that, we had the Bluebells, Upsetters, and Fredlocks, all singing about Paul Bogle. So that gives us a great idea about what the program is about this evening. Actually, I have no hot topic because I wanted to launch right in. So our hot topic is actually going to be a little bit of an introduction about the Morant Bay Rebellion. So that's where we're going to start. And from there, we'll bring in our co-host, Dr. Jatta, and then we have a special guest this evening. So you don't want to miss one moment of the Community Love Power Show this evening. So let's take just a few minutes and acquaint ourselves with the Morant Bay Rebellion, and then we will launch into our live program.
This is Jamaica's History Uncovered. Paul Bogle, a Baptist deacon, is remembered for his role in the Morant Bay Rebellion. His date of birth has been estimated between 1815 and 1822. He lived in Stony Gut, St. Thomas, just north of Morant Bay. Whilst many people in the area were small farmers and laborers, he was successful, well-educated, and owned about 500 acres of land. He was eligible to vote at a time when there were only 104 voters in the parish of St. Thomas, due in part to the large voting fee in order to participate. He became a supporter of landowner and politician and fellow Baptist George William Gordon. In 1864, Gordon made Bogle a deacon in the Baptist Church. As social injustices and people's grievances grew, Bogle led a group of small farmers 45 miles to discuss their grievances with Governor Eyre in Spanish Town, but they were denied an audience. This left the people of Stony Gut with a lack of confidence and deep distrust for government. This, while Bogle's supporters grew in number. beginnings of the Morant Bay Rebellion first started on October 7, 1865, when Bogle and his supporters attended a trial for two men from Stony Gun. A black man was put on trial and imprisoned for trespassing on a long-abandoned plantation. One member of Bogle's group protested in court over the unjust arrest and was immediately arrested, angering the crowd further. He was rescued moments later when Bogle and his men took to the market square and retaliated. The police were severely beaten and forced to retreat that day. On Monday the 9th, warrants were issued against Bogle and a number of others for riot and assault. The police arrived in Stony Gut to arrest Bogle, but met with stiff resistance from the residents. They fought the police, again forcing them to retreat to Morant Bay. A few days later, on October 11, 1865, there was a vestry meeting in the courthouse. Bogle and his followers, armed with sticks and machetes, went to the courthouse. The authorities were shaken, and a few people in the crowd threw stones at the volunteer militia who fired into the crowd, killing seven people. The crowd retaliated and set fire to the courthouse and nearby buildings. When the officials tried to leave the burning building, they were killed by the irate crowd outside. The reprisals came quickly. The troops destroyed Stony Gut and Paul Bogle's chapel. Bogle was captured by the Maroon militia and taken to Morant Bay, where he was put on trial and hung at the burnt-out courthouse. Gordon was taken by boat to Morant Bay, where he was tried for conspiracy and hung on October 23, 1865. In total, over 400 black residents were killed and many more flogged for their participation in the Morant Bay Rebellion. Back in Britain, there was a public outcry. There was increased opposition from liberals against Eyre's handling of the situation, and by the end of 1865, the Governor Eyre case had become the subject of national debate. In January 1866, a royal commission was sent to investigate the events. Governor Eyre was suspended and recalled to England and eventually dismissed. Jamaica became a crown colony, being governed directly from England. The Eyre controversy turned into a long and increasingly public concern, dividing well-known figures of the day, and possibly contributing to the fall of the government of Lord John Russell in 1866. The Morant Bay Rebellion turned out to be one of the dividing points in Jamaica's struggle for both political and economic enhancement. Bogle's demonstration ultimately achieved its objectives and paved the way for the new attitudes. In 1969, the Right Excellent Paul Bogle was named a national hero, along with George William Gordon, for their roles in paving the way for social justice and equality.
So what we've got here is, okay, can you hear me? Skype is saying no mic. Let's see. Dr. Jatt, are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
Okay, hopefully I wasn't on mute for that whole thing that I just 10 minutes. I didn't mute the mic, but somehow it muted. I was just speaking on facts about the Marat Bay Rebellion. So probably none of that got heard. But I'm not going to bother to repeat it. We have a special program this evening, and maybe it's all for the best. Because now we have you here, and, you know, I'm welcome to the program again. I'm so glad you're here this evening. And we have a special program, and it just really came up very spontaneously, and I really love that in the moment because this program is about what's current. So, you know, it is the 151st anniversary of the Marat Bay Rebellion right here in this little span of days that we're living right now. So I wanted to bring you in, and you had read a list of people and what had happened to them. So we can start wherever you want to start, but I want to make sure that we realize how many people were freedom fighters and how many people gave up their lives, their families, etc., their well-being, their health, their material possessions for this freedom fight. So maybe you can open the door for us and tell us a little more, please.
Yes, it's really an honor to have this topic on view on the docket today. We're inclined to forget easily the people that really sacrificed their lives for our liberation. In the Marat Bay Rebellion and the aftermath, they say over 500 people were hung. The countless that were whipped, we don't even know the amount. Houses burnt. Over 1,000 homes are burnt to the ground. Whole villages were destroyed. The people had no recourse with modern weapons, just coming from slavery. And our illustrious queen and her militia made sure that the poor people who petitioned her for land, because after slavery, the people had no land to farm. A petition was sent to England, and Marcus Garvey's father was one of the names on the petition, bequesting the queen for some of her land that they could cultivate as a cooperative measure so they could feed themselves. The reply that came back was very auspicious. I have it here in front of me. Her words were, paraphrased, were, "The prosperity of the laboring and all other parties in Jamaica depends on three things. For them to prosper, they had to have wages. They had to work for wages was the number one thing. They couldn't have any uncertainty or capricious behavior or impulsive behavior. They had to be steadily, continuously working for as long as their labor was wanted." This is her reply to these people that's been depressed for 200 years. They had to work for wages. And they had to work until their labor, as long as their labor is warranted. The hard work, they would find their solution to their difficulties. And through the hard work, they would acquire the wisdom to solve their problems. So this is somebody whose teeth turned white from eating too much sugar. These people worked generationally in cane fields to provide for the comforts of these people, and this is her reply to these people, that they had to work for wages. So it's no wonder that after receiving something like this from their illustrious benefactor, Majesty, that this is just one of the tipping stones that really made the people realize that nobody was really interested in their interest. We also tend to Go ahead.
Yeah, so what you're basically saying is the people that actually have built up the economy and built up the queen, you know, for her to have her sugar to rot out her teeth, and now in this quasi-freedom, because really it wasn't, and the people were still enslaved, and, you know, they, and still all of that, they went through the protocol and address the queen to request,
yes.
And she sent back something saying you have to work for that, basically. Is that basically what that was?
Yeah, the nobility of these people, these so-called poor people, barefoot people, the protocol they used, it was wonderful to see how exhausting they were in applying through the proper channels that was at their disposal, petitioning the queen because they were her subject, in a way that they would ask for just a piece of land to cultivate that we can eat, because after slavery, imagine that all the means of production is finished. You know, the plantation owner doesn't have labor anymore that he could slave labor to work the fields. The people had no jobs. And he had nobody to work the fields. And they had no tools or any industry. So, you know, the things are very bad at that time in Jamaica after slavery. It's the same in right here in the United States. So they sent a request to their beloved queen for just some land that they could plant. And she's telling them, well, listen, the only way you're going to get ahead is to work. And work until your labor is no longer wanted. And through working like this, you will earn wages. And that's going to help you get out of your difficulty.
yeah, that, you know, yeah, that, and there, that is duplicated around the planet in terms of taking the resources or the labor of people, building up economic empowerment for them, you know, be the ruling class, and then keeping the people in, you know, different forms of slavery after slavery has so-called ended vis-a-vis the prison system and, you know, the current global situation. So we're right at the bottom of the hour, and we have a special guest this evening who is on the line, and I want to open up the line and invite him in. Just before I do that, you know, I have to also go into the qualifications of our guests. We have such illustrious people, such genius, and such creativity that comes through this program, and it's really an honor to be able to be here and ask questions. So we have with us Dr. Muhammad A. Al-Rahman, and he has lots of titles and so forth, lots of accomplishments. I will just touch on a couple of them. He's now the interim chairman and clinical coordinator and pastoral services director of the Council of Mubalingans of the Americans and the Caribbean. I probably messed up that word. Director of the Faith and Cultural Wellness Project and managing partner of Culture, Wellness, and Development for Marriages and Family Therapy. He has a doctorate in psychology, clinical pastoral psychotherapy, and he is a New York State licensed marriage and family therapist. He's a national clinical fellow of the American Association for Marriage and Family Therapy and a diplomat of the American Psychotherapy Association. And he is presently a board-certified professional counselor of the American Psychotherapy Association. And on. He's highly qualified and just very articulate and a genius, and that's why he's on this program. Because whenever we have a conversation, I'm always just, you know, in awe and greatly honored. So let me open the line for Dr. Al-Rahman. Okay. Welcome.
Yeah, greetings.
Can you hear me? Greetings. How are you? Yes, loud and clear.
Yeah, no, yeah. I'd love to meet the person you're introducing that without that illustrious stuff. I'd love to meet him myself. If you have those people around, it'll be a pleasure to meet him. So, I'm humbled that you introduce him like that. So tell him, I'd love to meet him at some point one day. But you know, greetings and welcome to them.
Maybe we can meet him at Morant Bay, you know?
Maybe, yeah, we'll find where him live. I'd like to meet him myself.
we can meet him in Stony God.
Yeah, true. I'd like to meet him myself. So I heard some of your discussion about the letter to the Queen and the Paul Bogle situation. I guess that's the topic of the day in terms of your discussion. And I think that I like to kind of begin in terms of just my little two cents in terms of an important thing that I think that if we want to look at that situation and understand it to its fullest, we have to look at in the larger social fabric of Jamaica, for example. And I just want to kind of go back to a story. There's this idea that is out there by a scholar named Barbara Myhoff. She talks about the idea of people, place, and story. And in a discussion of that concept, she talks about that the human family is distinguished by the idea that they are the only one that have this homonarchic people-telling tradition. And part of the problem, as you look at the Paul Bogle situation and then look at it in terms of a continuum history, is to ask the question, is that story or other similar stories a dynamic part of the curriculum that's taught from elementary to the university system? And I go back to an event that stayed with me for a number of years. I remember when I was, you know, as a youth and growing up in, my grandmother had this, you know, like it's a tenement, but there was only family living in this one tenement that she had. So my uncle was much older than she was, and he was involved with all kind of cultural stuff. And so normally there's a routine every day when he comes. He comes to the house and he's nicely dressed. She served him his breakfast. And so when they were getting older, she couldn't see as much. She asked one of us to read the newspaper. So they will begin the newspaper and read the newspaper article. And then from maybe breakfast time to lunch time, they get into all kind of conversation about politics, religion, and history. So as young people, we're playing and we're overhearing the conversation. But one thing stayed me over the years, and I was trying to understand it, what it really meant. As you get older, you begin to kind of do a lot of stuff, living the continent and being other places. You begin to understand how powerful the idea in Jamaica is about the village versus the ghetto. Now, there's a man who was among them. He was, for all intents and purposes, very strong. But he had some challenges when he was older. He got hit by a car, and I think that it affected him neurologically, and he had speech impediment. And so sometimes it's very difficult to discern what he was saying. But one of the most dynamic thing about them was that whenever he wanted to say something, they would become silent. And then when he expressed himself, there was this moment of joy in his whole body, mind, body, and spirit just become so joyous that he used to go into this dance. So although he was someone that was challenged, they found a way to involve him into the conversation. Because he had something to say. And whether it was discernible to them or not, the mere fact that he had an opportunity to have the conversation was very dynamic. So I think the mere idea that you have in this forum to go back and look at some of the preconditions that could have contributed to what was happening with Paul Bogle, it raises question: to what extent are those conversations present in Jamaica now based upon those similar historical situations that was faced by the people? Are those contributory factors to the rise in crime, the rise in violence, are those unresolved societal issues that's been so compounded because of disconnection from cultural self that we need to kind of examine that, not just at that historical 1865 time, but in terms of 2016? What are some of the considerations? That are some of the things as I hear you talk, I was thinking about. Does that make sense? Hello? Can you hear me?
Yes, hold on.
Okay.
Yes, I'm back in.
Okay. So can you hear me? So does it make sense?
Exactly. Everything that you said, yes, it makes absolute sense because we want to connect what happened 151 years ago with what's happening in Jamaica today. So
and to add something to that, there's a conversation that I told Jatha, Dr. Jatha, to check out. There's a book by a scholar that was called I'll get title for you in a minute, but he was talking about the fact that when you talk about the Emancipation Proclamation, that a lot of scholars give attribution to what was going on in Europe. But he said that if you go back and look at the history, Abdulkadir Khan, who was from Futa Toro, is attributed as being one of the founders of this whole idea of Emancipation Proclamation in terms of... Yeah, so he's saying he's attributing his contribution that is something that is that occurred in the continent in West Africa that has been some part of the catalyst for what eventually became Emancipation Proclamation. But most times most of our people are not aware of that. So for example, if you were to say that, like when I was talking to Jada, I said about 29 times you have a lot of rebellion in Jamaica. What are some of the oral narratives that may have been continuous in Africa that contributed to those situations where they rebelled when they were basically oppressed in terms of, you know, real dehumanizing condition? Because you got to talk about that 29 rebellions in the Caribbean, but also that this Kadir Khan has been attributed to being the founder, that actually brought about some of those transformative moments in Africa. And in the slave voyages, those Africans who came and were aware of those oral narratives, what, if any, were some of those vestiges still remaining with them that brought them in when they came into slavery and they shared it as part of the oral narrative of the culture? The other thing is that, for example, so if you want to look at, for example, there's a book, I'll tell you the name of the book, it's by Dr. Wade Nobles, it's called About the Island of Memis, Haitian Unfinished Revolution. And it's a book was published recently, and it's 2005. But if I years ago, in a conversation with a Haitian colleague of mine, you talk about Bookman also coming out of that same environment and going to Haiti and making a major contribution in the Haitian Revolution. So go ahead. I'm with you.
I'm with you. So you're drawing the correlation. Yes, Dr. Jatha.
No, go ahead.
No, you go ahead, please. I was just opening the way for you to, for us to draw the correlation between the Haitian Revolution and what's happening in Jamaica now and at that time. We bring it all together.
Yes, this is such a wide subject. It was because of the Haitian uprising why the British were so cruel and malicious with the people in Jamaica to make sure to teach them a lesson, because they didn't need anybody else finding liberty and setting up their own state as Haiti did. So I can see that particular correlation. My thing that I'd like to bring up is, how do we have the Paul Bogle situation in our fiber in Jamaica, in the Jamaican memory, in the world memory, because this situation changed the world, the Morant Bay, and we have to say the Morant Bay Rebellion, because it wasn't just one man. There were many, many people involved in this, sacrificed their life, Paul Bogle being one. Because it was from this rebellion here that Britain formulated their idea of scientific racism, and they used that in their imperial conquest of the world to say that African people were different genetically, they had different heads, they didn't have the same mental capacity as the European. Even their hearts were different. These conclusions were formed by the populace in England after the time of the Morant Bay Rebellion. So a very strategic point in human rights in the world came from that. But I would like to find out, how can we get these lessons to be taught, just like a Nancy was taught to us, to the children in Jamaica, that they will get to understand the significance of the rebellion? You know, the people strove for self-reliance. They strove for their own liberation. You know, they strove for justice for themselves. If these things are taught properly to the youths as lessons, they will come with an inventive idea about life, a freedom idea about life, and so forth and so forth. So how is that going to get into the culture, Dr. Muhammad? Through the music, through the school system? How do we do that? That we don't forget
well,
these.
Good question. You know, if you just kind of, Paul Bogle became maybe a crescendo in terms of 1865, but you got to go back from the very founding of the nation itself. You got to go back and, for example, let's take, you and I talk all the time. If you were to then take, for example, the art form of reggae music, for example, they always say that Satamasagana is one of the, I guess, the anthem of reggae music. But if you listen to the words of Satamasagana, It in the narrative of Satamasagana, it is kind of reconnecting the people in Jamaica to the African ancestry. And there's different versions of the music. For example, you know, there's a DJ part, say, Ana in a barn, Satamiki Ana. So there's all this larger village conversation. And about a couple of years ago, my father passed away by the Jamaican. I was talking to my sister. And I said to her, I said, if I was to ask you, what is a moment in the Jamaican life where there's a major figure that is having that village conversation, who would you think as a woman who's doing that? She took maybe about 5 minutes to answer. I said, it take too long. And so when I was growing up, we had Miss Lou. So Miss Lou would script a conversation about language and about the connection of the three language, and as part of the dialogue and the discourse with Jamaican people. Because when you say talking about broken English, it's not broken English. There are word usages that are adapted from the three languages that's part of the normative conversation. Then you have the reggae music that's part of that conversation. Then you have the learning sets in the village where, for example, sometimes you're the Rastaman discussing history, religion, politics. So as a youth, you sit down at the same time. So you have these parallel systemic village systems that are based upon what relationship, because African folks are based upon relationship in terms of the extended the village raising the family. So in these different village spaces, you have the conversation taking place. So it becomes a total conversation. I don't know to what extent is that that part of the cultural fabric now, in terms of it's still there, but to the extent that curriculum, resource material is developed, reading material, oral things that are connected to that. I'm not sure where that is in Jamaica at this particular point, but when we grew up, that was available. So, for example, we always have this song, you know, I talk about it all the time. Baba, black sheep, have you any wool? Yes, sir, yes, sir, three bags full. And the way the song is sing is that one for the master, one for the maid, but none for the child who cried down the lane. So it the cry of poverty, so it didn't treat that child well. Here comes the song in terms of a redone of the song. The song says, "Ba ba baya, greetings, my blessed Helda. You know, have you any wool? Wool is something that's produced because of fabric of production. Yes, sir, 3 bags full, one for bread, aye, one for bunga, aye, but none for the pork eater." So, in other words, it kind of reformat the conversation to say we have to kind of look at the conversation differently. So in order for that story to become a part of the living legacy of the people, you need those kind of conversations, not just in the academic sense or the culture of the universities and the school, but also the village schools as well, where you have those conversations in the big yard or, you know, around the domino table, wherever the people are, to kind of recultivate and kind of resensitize their people to their own history.
Next one. True.
Because that's the missing part of the narrative. Because those are, for example, where, you know, some of the issues that we were dealt with in the song, or you solve, you know, like John Holcomb said, don't watch those girls passing by, fancy makeup all over their faces, ruby handbags to match their dress, the fancy necklace around their neck. You're saying that that's not the criteria we got to use about what womanhood is about. It has to be something else. It has to be something that's substantive, have to bring, because that's also a false notion of maybe a role that a person is playing. So those songs was asking us to look differently and then find cultural metaphors that is giving, ascribing beauty. Like Dennis Brown said, where can I find the black Cinderella? Giving ascription to African norms of what's beautiful, what's gracious. So those are the kind of thing that pre-made it, so that in the music, in the poetry, in the pantomime, in the elementary school, the high school, the junior high, all the way up, you had those kind of conversations taking place at different levels. So that was the dynamic of Jamaican culture at that time. To the extent that it exists now, I'm not sure. What and that level, it still is there, but I'm not sure. I can't accurately say exactly what are the different dynamics of that mechanism now. But I know when we grew up back then, that was a dynamic.
Okay.
It makes sense.
That makes perfect sense.
Oh yes.
Okay.
Oh, yeah.
All right. So, okay. Some saying that was part of, and then all, not just the idea of what, like Barbara Biafra says, the people, the place, and the story, the narrative. The narrative also talk about benevolence to one's neighbor. So, for example, if you and I was cousins and we live in the same house. And our producer of the program is a young woman who was bright and had some skills in her. Said, a mother may say to her, said, listen, go tell Mr. Brown to tend the girls next door and take this to him to eat, because his wife is not coming back until late. So she makes sure that he got something to eat, but she's going to tell her, said, go help them girls with the homework. So there's a kind of stewardship or responsibility. Maybe the mother may have told her that the girl's having a hard time with maybe Matt, and maybe your daughter's busy or maybe something. Ask your daughter to find some time to help them. So maybe the mother's out doing something. So this is a way for you to kind of then become a tutor. So we live in the continent, you see the same thing. Because in the African culture, for example, in West Africa, Senegal, in Touba, when the young kids are in the Dongodar, the traditional school system, it's the younger men who have gone on and studied and memorized the Quran who come back and become the teachers for them at that stage in terms of the penmanship and preparing to memorize the book. So they go to the traditional circle in the mosque to learn and come back. And they go to the village scholar and they learn things from him. So when they're working with the cousins, the younger brother, age set suggests that the younger people listen to them more, because it have a different kind of relationship between the, it's like a peer learning kind of thing at a different level for them. So that kind of create a kind of orderliness, a kind of stewardship, a kind of responsibility. So if you have those things that are occurring at the same time, you can learning can develop. Like the other night, President Obama was in that, ANT, and he's talking about the idea of his program and my brother's keeper, the mentorship. that if you look at the paradigm itself is an African paradigm.
Yeah, for sure.
It's because it's rites of passage. You know, you and I come out of rites
right.
of passage and our chest is up, big and feel. But your father said, no, that don't mean anything. You got to respond to your little brother. Now you got to share some of that with him. And so, coming out of that rites of passage, you find that if so, as the president talk about the idea that, for example, that he's talking about the brass keeper, you see the African paradigm at work. And because it provides mentor, provides something a youth can say, well, maybe I was where you are at one point, and this, you know, this is the way I handle the situation. So he then becomes a better mentor because he has developed certain kind of assets and skills that he can then turn around and connect with that young man better than you and I can. We come into the picture later on because we become a mediator, but you have an immediate peer relationship that's being fostered to fill a gap. Maybe the child is the only child. Maybe grew up in the foster care system. Whole host of factors could be part of the process, but the idea that you have this mechanism is dynamic. So to answer the question, maybe I went over, but the idea is that if you want to kind of understand the narrative and understand the sense of continuum, Paul Pogo became a high point, but there were things that happened with Mama Nani up to 1739 when they signed that treaty that continued because there were dissatisfaction that was still unaddressed. Things were unaddressed, and so it kind of morphed into that situation. So we need to look at those. So you got to look at it in terms of its totality. You can't look at it just purely linear. You have to look at it in a kind of holistic way and say, well, what are the implications? How does that affect this?
So a question. What effect or influence would the narratives have had on the 151-year-ago Morant Bay Rebellion, the type of narratives that you're describing? Was that more prevalent then than it is now? And so we see a shift or a change or a diminishment, you know, of the cohesion of the culture. Did those narratives or those conversations that were passed from family to family or generation to generation affect or inspire the people to rebel at Morant Bay and beyond?
Well, in some, like Michael Malice said one time, the reggae music became the vehicle of the narrative of struggle on the island
mm-hmm.
for the people.
Okay.
In its form, and Bob Marley became one of his dynamic ambassadors, and so does Burning Spear. And if you look at what Bob talks about in the music, talk about some of the same issues that we still face today. And so what it says is that, if you go back to Father Garvey said that for a man to know himself is for the man to feel that from there's no human master, and the people not of his true path like a tree without root. So if I'm not grounded in looking in the mirror and like self in terms of what I see, and there are different schools of psychology, you know, the first, second, and third wave. And they'll tell you that in terms of even the work of Bowlby about how attachment affects bonding and what Dr. Annie talks about in terms of the Maafa and the Sankofa, in order to kind of return to the Sankofa in terms of the paradigm, you got to understand exactly what had happened. And if you don't have a sense of appreciating yourself as an individual, how can you appreciate the next person that looks like you? Sometimes you're going to come up with kind of mix up more than attitudes with that person because you don't know. But what was happening was that if you go back and look at some of the vintage reggae music, it was asking the people to address those questions. It was raising those kind of issues to say, well, that we're bridging. Like Sata Masagana said, he said, Dena Masagan Ule is it is. He said, thou shalt not steal, said the Lord Almighty who ruled the turn. He said, how good it is for brethren to dwell in love and unity. It says, for example, to eat from thy own vineyard is sweet to the soul, but to sweet from thy bread is bitter to the belly. So here within the fabric of the music, it's telling us then, taking a text from the Bible, if you're a Christian, or it says, don't covet your neighbor's good. But Sata Masagana said, no, it is deeper than that. Let's continue the conversation. To eat from thy own vineyard, to produce, to be dynamic, to be self-sufficient is a bona fide thing. But to steal from thy brethren is bitter to the belly, because the consumer of it is not healthy. So it's creating the mindset that tells us, wait a second, me and this man should dwell in love overnight. How can we do that? How can we do that? We said, but to steal from him is a moral aberration. We have to avoid that. So the music was raising those kind of questions and setting as a part of narrative and part of the storytelling how we should go about doing some of those things. And so if you're not, just like, for example, we're going up the Nancy Tucuma, the nemesis between the Nancy and the Tucuma, and the fact that it always tell it was a moral kind of imperative to kind of educate us as people about the role of responsibility. The same thing in the music was doing a similar type of activity. So if you wanted to kind of then say, how do you kind of continue the narrative in a kind of productive and transformative way, it has to be on the different levels within the village community, because you're dealing with different skill sets, different experience of the people. And so you have to find a kind of holistic way to kind of be inclusive in the conversation. Because there's visual oral learners, there's a whole lot of
mm-hmm.
different circumstances.
Right.
So we got to find a way to allow this work. It's just, you know, even as funny as it is, like, for example, even in the, that's why Miss Lou was so dynamic. The language itself, for example, in the bartering, I mean, there was this kind of respectful place in terms of buying something. And so in the language, that was always existed. You had a bartender that was there, and the kind of nuances that was part of that respectful conversation in the discourse. But if you don't find a way to embellish and understand and educate the people about the foundations of what they utilize as part of their cultural script, then there are going to be some moments where you're going to lack continuum in terms of what is necessary. So a way to look at that is, say, for example, how then can we come up with a total narrative that kind of engages us in dynamic ways to kind of do a transformation? That's what we have to ask ourselves.
Okay, so we reached the top of the hour already. And as I said, it goes so fast. I feel like we just beginning to talk about the topic. So we have to have you
come
back again. And
no,
we
have time. We can do that again. Yeah, but, you know, give thanks to the opportunity for those black women still. But, you know, we have to have the conversation as a people. It is a necessary one.
Right.
It is going to be part of the transformative thing. So man respect man, woman respect woman, respect all people. Because things are doing in the country now against the world people, them is a violation of the very code of African people's conduct, going all the way back to the first human couple,
yeah,
which, you know, is an African paradigm. Cause, you know, all of this science and thing go back and they acknowledge that. And so it's not a question of if or not. The debate is done. And if we get a chance, Dr. Theophila Benga and Dr. Diop, the 1974 UNESCO report kind of does put all that to rest. So if you get a chance, you can look it up. Probably try so you can get access for public and link it up so you can look at it. But the foundation idea is that, you know, if we have to kind of, we have to become comfortable with that primordial part of who we really are as African people. And then once you get that kind of comfortability, the narrative relationship is an important institution that is a very fundamental and dynamic part of that. So we need to kind of find a way as y'all people then, and as people in the Caribbean and the diaspora, to kind of go back to that. How do we get back there and kind of move us in a certain kind of direction? So Paul Broke is just an example of some of the frustrations and the oppression and what happened. But it was a build-up to that. You can't look at it in isolation. You look at it in terms of the totality of the whole thing.
All right, so, you know, we just kind of picked something out of the continuum of what's happening, but it's true. We can't
mm-hmm.
just, you know, start there. We have to, as you said earlier on, look at some of the, you know, the innate causes of these things that have been happening over generations. So
mm-hmm.
I really have to have you come back, because we're just beginning the conversation and we could go so much longer. So
mm-hmm.
we will invite you back again.
Bless up. Give thanks. And Dr. Jess, bless up and give thanks.
you know, topic also that, you know, what, tell us, just give us a couple of insights into what you're currently working on.
One other thing I've been kind of thinking about is just, you know, I've been working on a text in particular about the experience of the project that we had in West Africa and Senegal with the youths. Guys, it's an important part of my son was saying, an important piece of narrative that need to be shared with the youth, because it kind of proscribes some of the things that you're talking about in terms of, it's like I was listening to President Obama last night, and he was saying that, you know, as we get older, he said, like, as old folks, he was making a point that the younger generation going to be the one that they're going to have the digits to kind of pay into the system for Social Security and to look for the elderly people. So he's saying that, you know, his program is not just an isolated program dealing with the needs of our folks. It's a greater need for it. And so as you begin to look at that, this project, this thing I'm working on, is looking at kind of find a way to kind of create some of the continuum that I use to kind of see the value of connection to the African self. And so whatever narrative or things can be done to kind of tell a dynamic story is, when Dr. Jatta was part of the project, we were working on a project in the continent. One of our beloved colleague who passed, I was part of it. And the idea was a very novel idea. So we were talking about some of the ideas so it can be shared and people can get insight as to exactly the normity of what was attempted. You know, as part of, not just as a part of the isolation, but part of the same continuum as well. And even when you understand that, I think I heard Dr. Omar Johnson talk about this in one of his presentations about and Garvey having over 200 or more, I think, if the number is incorrect, I can stand correct, but I can double check the number, segments of the UNIA in Africa set up at that one time. And I heard Dr. Ben making a pronouncement the other day in one of his previous things about some of the same things. Some of these African leaders was an important part of that. So although Garvey, as a diasporic African, was in the diaspora, there's always this connection that we talk about in Sata that says you honor, but you know, banya. That kind of emphasis to kind of reconnect. So the reconnection is always an important part of our dynamic. It's part of the paradigm of the Sankofa. In terms of the symbolism of the Sankofa.
Yes.
And I see it on your site, and you're familiar with that. So as you see that, you know,
yes.
You know, you have so this is what, excuse me, this piece is about, trying to kind of find, looking at that to kind of connect in dynamic ways. Because we have to continue the dialogue, the narrative in its form, and things like this, and off-the-cuff chat, like Malcolm always says, is always important, because it helps to kind of sow the seed. So, you know. So that's some of the things that I'm concerned about.
I'm so glad we were able to at least begin the conversation, because this is the beginning, and then from that becomes action, because, you know, it's not just about talking, but we have to begin the conversation and then, you know, take that in the direction that we need to for freedom and liberation through the entire diaspora. So, Dr. Jatta, what are your closing words for us this evening, please?
I admire a man that owned 500 acres of land and businesses and bank accounts in the United States, as Paul Bogle did, to relinquish all of those things to come down to serve the poor people. So I get a great lesson from that. You know, he could have accepted his comforts in life and pay no attention to the sufferer. But he negated all of that to do what he did, to walk 45 miles to Spanish Town with another petition to the governor there, walk all the way, didn't even get a chance to see the governor, walk all the way back another 45 miles to Stony Gutty, Moran Bay. You know, so those that have, always got to remember those that don't.
Bless up. Give thanks. Yes. Solid example. Solid vision.
Yes. Yes.
Solid.
Thanks. Thanks to all those who called in, listening. We appreciate you, those of you in the chat as well. Those of you who listen to the archive, and we will be here again on Sunday at 6 p.m. Eastern time. And we will, I'll bring you the, check the email, your marketing email for the topic, or you can check the show page in another day or so to see what the topic will be for Sunday. Perhaps we'll continue this conversation because we're in the time frame, you know, and we just got started and the time is up. Speaking of Spear, we're gonna exit with Burning Spear. This is Yah Elohim. Thank you for listening. And join us again on Sunday at the same time, 6 p.m. on blogtalkradio.com/dimensional healing. This is the Community Love Power Show.